hip-hop, the most popular music in America, is now middle-aged. Let's rap about it on this episode of Pop Life.
Digital content on WAER is supported by California Closets of Syracuse, creating custom storage solutions for all areas of the home, as well as in professional offices and commercial spaces. Learn more at californiaclosets.com or by visiting their DeWitt showroom.
The year was 1979. I was in junior high school when an unknown group called the Sugar Hill Gang dropped a song named Rapper's Delight.
Now what you hear is not a test. I'm rapping to the beat.
The beat was familiar and hypnotic. The bass-driven Good Times by the band Chic was a radio hit earlier in the year and now served as the bed for spoken word lyrics unlike anything I'd ever heard on radio. That song started legendary debates on what constituted music and original creativity and gave new meaning to the word sample. Welcome to Pop Life. I'm Joe Lee. With many of hip-hop's founding contributors now in their 50s and 60s, it's safe to say that the music that many critics predicted would go the way of other fads is now all grown up and middle-aged. Helping me explore the music's humble beginnings and its tremendous influence on popular American culture is Don Sawyer, Vice President for Equity and Inclusion and Associate Professor of Sociology at Quinnipiac University, where he teaches a Sociology of Hip-Hop course. Don is also a dear friend. Welcome to the show, bruh.
Thank you for having me.
I wish we had you on our previous episode. We did Pop Culture in the Classroom. So I would love to have had you on the show to talk about what you're doing in a classroom when it comes to sociology of hip hop. So tell me a little bit about the focus of the class and the intent of the lesson plan.
Well, so first and foremost, I let students know that this is not a music appreciation course.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some students hear hip hop and they hear sociology and come in and think we're going to just listen to a Jay-Z album and say whether or not it was hot. But what we're doing is looking at society through the lens of hip-hop. And so we're covering, you know, sociological theory. We're looking at capitalism. We're looking at misogyny. We're looking at homophobia. We're looking at the war on drugs, the crack cocaine epidemic. We're looking at so many different things that happen in society. We're looking at it through the lens of hip-hop culture and kind of engaging in a sociological analysis of the influence that hip-hop has had on the world.
Yeah, I mean, because it's difficult separating the music, this particular music, from the culture itself. And when you're looking at it through that lens and all of the sort of celebrations and ills that you just outlined, it's a really interesting thing to study. When you think about hip-hop music, how do you define it?
So when I think about hip-hop, right, and so one of the things that I get students, like, from the day one is to separate, you know, hip-hop, the culture, and the music of, which is, you know, rap. Like, hip-hop, rapping is something you do, and hip-hop is something you live. Like, rap is the music of the culture. And so that's kind of how we situate the music in the class, as we're looking at the culture of hip-hop and rap as being part of that culture.
Okay, so school us. Hip-hop culture is?
And so hip-hop culture, when we think about the culture, we think about the four elements. We think about the breaking, the dancing, the rapping, the MC, the DJ, and the graffiti and the writing. And then the fifth element, the overarching element, is the knowledge, right, the knowledge of self. And so that's what constitutes, you know, the culture of hip-hop.
Mm-hmm. So there's a sizable gap between my age and your age, I believe. And you heard me talk about my earliest interaction with hip-hop. What's your earliest memory? I mean, so it was brand new. It was a brand new music hitting radio. So living in Baltimore, Maryland, outside of New York City, you know, it was not a part of the culture. So that was a smack in the face. I would imagine when you're coming up, it's already somewhat established. So what's your first memory?
So my first memory is actually the Sugar Hill record, as you mentioned, right? And so, like, I'm 43, right? And so I'm born in 76. So Sugar Hill comes out in 79. And so the thing that I remember is seeing the album in my uncle's bedroom, you know, the light blue with, like, the multicolored cornucopia on the album cover. And that was one of my earliest memories of seeing that record, you know, constantly being played. And so growing up in New York City, in Harlem at the time, like, I didn't know the word hip-hop, right? Like, I didn't know what it was, mm-hmm. in the sense of it, what it was named, but I saw it, right? And so, you know, at the age of six, you know, learning how to break, learning how to, you know, do a mean backspin and different things of that nature, like getting paid money at, you know, my family's card parties to moonwalk and do certain things, mm-hmm. Those are my earliest memories of it. And so my generation, like, you know, those of us who were born, like, in 76, like, we're the generation that comes up with hip-hop culture. Like, my father's generation, he's born in 56. And so he was there during the formation of the culture. But I think we were the first generation to kind of actually live it, mm-hmm. like, from a youth all the way through until adulthood.
Right. I mean, I could do none of that stuff. So when Rapper's Delight dropped. Now, I'll be honest, to my great shame, I was one of the kids who predicted that this would not last, that this was pure fad, because I was into R&B and rock and roll. So, but what I distinctly remember just from the first couple of weeks, unlike anything else before it, where you sort of, as you heard songs over and over, you sort of pick up the lyrics and you start... People were specifically trying to remember these rap lyrics so they could rap along with the record. That was the first time I'd ever experienced anything like that when it came to sort of mimicking what you were hearing on the radio. Is that your recollection? Were people, like, just really honing in on these lyrics and trying to get that stuff down, trying to get that rhythm down and that flow down?
Yeah, I mean, I remember doing it, right? Like, memorizing lyrics. I mean, there are lyrics, you know, from my childhood that I can memorize now. And when I talk with my kids about it, and they're like, how do you remember these songs? I'm like, I don't know. I can remember learning them and using the tape, and I would write out the lyrics. Mm-hmm. And I would press pause, write out the lyrics, you know, press pause again, let it play, and I would write out, you know, all of these lyrics until I can commit them to memory. And I also remember, like, in sixth grade, I used memorized lyrics to try and win the heart of a girl. I was in sixth grade. I memorized LL Cool J's "I Need Love" to recite it to. I'm not going to say her name, but I recited it to her in the gym. You know, to highlight my love for her. So yeah, hip hop was good to me, but memorization of the lyrics was important as well.
Yeah, it had that cool factor. Unlike a lot of other music genres that have been around for much longer periods of time, rap music actually has a pretty well-recorded and recognized timeline, thanks to its relative youth. Most historians place its humble beginnings somewhere in 1973 when DJ Kool Herc threw a party. It was like a back-to-school fundraiser to help one of his siblings buy some school clothes. Started mm-hmm. speaking and rhyming over a music bed just on a microphone with some turntables, and there you have it, right?
August 11th, 1973 is the date that they give. So that's hip-hop's birthday. And August 11th, 1976, Don Sawyer was born. So I share a birthday with hip-hop. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's pretty cool. And then from there, so we talked a little bit about the Sugar Hill Gang, but from there you start introducing the scratching of records from Grandmaster Flash, and then I think folks outside of New York City who had never heard that before started having a real WTF moment. It was like, what in the world is this sound? But it mm-hmm. was so unique, and people just started mimicking that, not just by scratching records, but trying to do it with their vocal cords.
Absolutely. And so one of the things with Grandmaster Flash, like, he's the one who mastered it. I mean, I think most people give credit to the scratching creation, to Grand Wizard Theodore, who accidentally stumbled upon the idea of scratching. I think he was playing music, and his mom came in telling him to turn it down. So he used his hand to kind of pull the record back to stop it from playing and start to hear that sound and what happened when he could stop and let it go and stop and let it go. And then Grandmaster Flash comes along and, like, perfects it. Like, he put a science to mixing and blending and scratching. So something that started out somewhat accidental then gets added into this art form.
And then so Rapper's Delight was the first hit to sort of break that top 40. But then in 1980, Curtis Blow drops These Are the Breaks.
Clap your hands, everybody, if you got what it takes. Because I'm Curtis Blow, and I want you to know that.
And that becomes hip-hop's first certified gold record, right?
Yeah, and I remember it.
Yeah.
I remember it, and, you know, seeing Curtis Blow with his jerry curls and just, like, the idea that you can make a record, right? I think that was the part that surprised people, because if you think about hip-hop wasn't necessarily recorded on wax, right? People had tapes, you know, that they would record, you know, live battles and, you know, recording, you know, the parties and stuff like that. And so when you get the Sugar Hill Gang, when you get, you know, Curtis Blow, and people are like, wait a minute, you can make songs and you can make records from this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's when it starts off. And when you talk about a record going gold, like from this culture that no one really knew about,
mm-hmm.
but hits the scene, and then you talk about a record going gold.
Yeah, I mean, I remember even as, you know, as a kid, as a teenager, people who knew music, they were DJs, writers, were having this debate about whether or not this was music and whether or not it was a legitimate art form. And because of they're using other people's music, it's like, where's the real creativity come in from? And it, you know, we started putting a whole new meaning to the word sample, you know, where they're sampling other people's music to create their own. So very interesting history for this music. In terms of the cultural impact, you know, we go from music consumers, we go from costumed acts like Earth, Wind & Fire, Funkadelic, the Isley Brothers. So they're all wearing these sort of elaborate, flashy, sequenced outfits that you and I would never wear. and then you go from that to Adidas and Kangols and gold chains, and that's reflective of what the audience was wearing, right? So as we see these artists on their record, on their record covers, we see them in interviews, we see them in videos, they look like us.
Yeah, and so the interesting thing, though, if you remember before Run DMC, like the street element wasn't necessarily in the fashion fully, because if you remember, like, Grandmaster Flash and them, you know, wearing the leather suits, the cut-off shirts, the rabbit feet, you know, hanging off the side of your pocket,
right.
and the leather gloves with the rhinestones, like people around the block weren't dressing like that.
Right, right. Right.
And so then you get, you know, Run DMC and them coming out to, like, put that street element back into it, right?
You know,
with the all-black, the Adidas, you know. And so that's when we start to see the street element. Because
right.
I don't remember ever in my neighborhood seeing anyone dressed like Grandmaster Flash and Melly Mel and all of them. But,
yeah, because, see, they were picking up what you know, like Earth, Wind, and Fire, and then were putting down. And then comes Run DMC, LL Cool J, and they got the Kangols on, the Adidas, the Gazelle glasses, and gold chains, and they're reflecting what the fans are all about. R&B focused on love, relationships, and partying. Hip hop was about being fly or dope, down by law in those early days. And by the 80s and 90s, the lyrics get a little deeper. Can you tell us about some of the early evolutions of messaging in hip-hop lyrics?
Well, I mean, so it's interesting that you use the word messaging, because I think if you point to people around that time in the 80s, the message, right, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five comes out. And so you hear that song, right? So it's not about partying, right? It's not about, you know, trying to get the ladies or anything like that. But they're telling a story about what's taking place in urban centers, right? So not only is the beat catchy, right? You know, you have unbelievable lyricism and the ability to tell a sociologically relevant story happens in that song, the message, right? You know, this idea of don't push me because I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding what's being faced by these youth who are growing up in underserved, neglected communities, right? And to hear that come across to a beat, I think that blew the minds of people as well. So not only can you make a record, but you can actually say something that's socially significant, mm-hmm. talk about your reality, and get it put out there. So I think that was a global shift when I think about hip hop.
Yeah, no, and that particular song was pretty heavy. I mean, I remember listening to that. Even though I'm growing up inner city Baltimore, we had it pretty rough. But listening to that, I was like, man, brothers in New York got it pretty rough. I mean, that was a pretty heavy tune. Run DMC becomes the rap's first super group. I mean, they blew up, right? They were just larger than life. And then we had some other notable moments like Yo MTV Raps. We had the creation of Def Jam Records, and so we see the music go from just as you would expect it to do, go from enjoyable music to now a money making industry, and people capitalizing on the culture.
And I think that's the piece. And so what. Like the students in my class about, oh, back in the day, it wasn't about money. I'm like, well, it wasn't about money as we think about it now, but people were trying to get paid, right? You mm-hmm. were trying to win contests as an MC or as a DJ. You were trying to throw your parties to make a little money at the door or whatever. So people were trying to make money. They just didn't necessarily see that the type of money that rappers are getting right now, that wasn't necessarily seen as something that was possible, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you get people who are surprised that you can make a record. Then a record can go gold. Then you can make a record that actually is saying something that's socially significant. But now you have a rap group who's selling out stadiums. Like, mm-hmm. what? You have a rap group that's doing a collaboration with a rock group. Then you have a rap group who's getting a sneaker sponsorship, mm-hmm. right? And so, like, people, I don't think could foresee that it would be taken off in the way that it did. You know, during that time, and when we think about, you know, Jay-Z, we think about Diddy, and we think about, you know, Dre and Latifah and all of these multimillionaires within the hip-hop context, right? You know, talking about like the first hip-hop billionaire.
Mm-hmm.
I refuse to believe that people thought that was a possibility back then.
Yeah. You know, what I find interesting, though, is as the art form, the music and the culture began to proliferate American culture, there's still this period in the mid to late 90s and even early 2000s, and maybe even not even that long ago in the 2000s, where we're still sort of fighting for legitimacy, right? They're still trying to figure out how this music fits in music award shows like American Music Awards and the Grammys. There's still some sort of segregation and apartheid going on in these music industry platforms. And they're still fighting for legitimacy, even though it's becoming and now is the most popular music in America, right? So it's all grown up, didn't go away, didn't go the way of the fad that many people predicted it, but it's still fighting for this legitimacy. And then here we get Lauryn Hill comes along, wins rap's first Grammy Album of the Year. Kendrick Lamar wins a Pulitzer Prize, a damn Pulitzer, for the album Damn, right? And so, but it still feels like we're still fighting for legitimacy. Am I off base?
No, I mean, I think that you're on. Like, if you remember in the early award shows, even when they started to give awards for, like, rap albums, they wouldn't be televised. And if I'm not mistaken, I think it was you know, DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, who helped to lead a boycott, right, from one of the award shows. Like, I think it may have been the Grammys, because they weren't going to televise, you know, the rap portion and the people who won rap awards. And so even with Lauren and even with, you know, with Kendrick, you know, some people have gotten to the point to say that we don't need the Grammys and all of them to validate us. Like, hip-hop has been valid. Like, the Grammys don't necessarily matter because they get it wrong all the time, right? And so, but deep down inside, like, you want to be, I think, you know, MCs and other artists want to be acknowledged by the mainstream populations that kind of lead the awards, like, for music. But I do think it seems like at times we're still fighting to be seen as valid, even though we lead in so many ways. Like the number one music, the number one American export to the world is hip hop.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, there is no denying it's had a major impact on popular American culture. What are some of the most significant influences today that you see, either in language or fashion or attitude, whatever it is? What do you see as some of the major influences hip hop has had on popular American culture today?
I mean, I think about language, you know, adding word. I mean, just the language, you know, adding words to dictionaries, right? It's some of the stuff that comes up. I think about fashion. You know, thinking about like the cool hunts that were done, like, you know, these companies, these fashion companies, you know, coming into urban spaces to see how we were wearing things, right? To see how we were recreating things and then kind of taking the middle person out and doing it themselves, right? So you think about like Air Force Ones, the Nike shoe that people would paint, and then you get the company coming out, and then they're making the colors that the people, the street artists used to do with graffiti on jackets, you know, cut up jackets and cut up denim. The ways in which, you know, the industry has come in and seen what we were creating in these spaces, and then recreating it and selling it back to the originators of, you know, that style. When I think about advertising, like seeing rap, you know, advertising products, seeing Ronald McDonald doing a backspin and breakdancing on TV, selling burgers, chicken nuggets, right? You know, seeing, you know, all of these things and people taking bits and pieces of this culture and using it for their gain. And so again, like, I mean, these are things that people, I don't think could have imagined.
Yeah. I mean, you look at the world's most popular musical, Hamilton, is a hip hop. I mean, that thing blew me away when I saw it, you know, and as I sat there and watched it, I'm thinking I'm on Broadway watching a Broadway show and it's all hip hop. That blew my mind. That's crazy. It's one thing about, and I'm a music fan. I love a lot of different genres of music, but the thing I struggle with in thinking about other genres is the conversation you might have with someone about the feelings you have for a particular music. Maybe jazz. You might have a conversation about the first time you discovered jazz or the first artist that sort of blew you away, but I don't really see that happening with other music genres, and I could be wrong. It's just my opinion. But I'm going to play this clip from the movie Brown Sugar with Sanaa Lathan and Taye Diggs. This is the kind of conversation. This is obviously a fictional scene, but this is the kind of conversation that takes place all the time in hip-hop culture.
That song be reminding me of us.
It does?
Yeah, back in the day. You remember that feeling? Just how hip-hop used to make you feel, especially back then?
It was so real. It was like air. You remember how you felt?
The first time you heard "The Bridge Is Over."
Oh.
The first time?
Yep.
That was real.
Ooh, or "You Got to Chill."
With the
sophomore skate party.
Benita Applebaum, that was a tight one.
And Paul Revere. Oh, I used to love that.
See, now that beat was tight.
Now maybe it's because it is still a, you know, relatively young genre in the greater scope of things, that impacts a lot of us from a nostalgic standpoint. I just don't hear that kind of conversation with other music genres. Do you get the same thing? What is it about? What is it about this music that makes us get nostalgic like that?
I mean, I think part of it was the shock of it all, right? Like the idea, specifically for the people who were young at that time and being producers of the culture, it was a space where their voices were centered, right? Their voices were centered, and you saw youth culture on a main stage, right? So like, this is a part of me, right? And I am a part of it. And so when these songs come out, like, you remember that moment. It's almost like a scent, right? Like, sometimes you can smell something and it can take you back to a time where, you know, where you were. Like, if I smell some like Dracar Noir cheap cologne that I used to spray too much of on myself of, I can remember like where I was at the time when I first used it. And so when I hear the breaks, when I hear like Raw by Big Daddy Kane, like, I remember the first time I heard it. I remember buying the tape. Unfortunately, it was a bootleg that I got from the African Brother on 125th Street. That's all my pockets could afford at the time. But I remember getting that tape, right? I remember pressing play and rewinding and being mesmerized by the ways in which he was using similes and metaphors, right? So I remember that part of the music. And I'm sure if I was able to talk to my grandfather, you know, who was a big jazz buff, he could remember the first time he originally heard, you know, Thelonious, or the time that he heard Miles, or the first time he heard B.B. King play. You know, he used to like the blues as well. But it's just something about hip-hop that you felt that it was you, that it was your voice, and that you felt that you mattered for that moment in time when that song released.
Yeah, the only thing that for me that comes close to that I might be able to imagine would be someone's experience when the Beatles first came out. I mean, it's that big. I remember just my buddy Aaron Easter and I just waiting, because we, back when there used to actually be record stores, we would wait for this store to open up so we can be the first to get a copy of Public Enemy's latest CD. I mean, not CD, but cassette. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that we that kind of thing. Just we miss that today. We don't have that kind of anticipation and all that with even in hip hop today. I mean, you hear about something's going to drop, you'll go get it. But that kind of enthusiasm and anticipation just doesn't exist anymore. So Curtis Blow is now 60. Jay-Z's 50. Dr. Dre's 54. Chuck D's 59. Queen Latifah's 49. The music's grown up. And so it's interesting to see. It'll be interesting to see where we're going to go from here. Who are the shapers and leaders of today? Who are going to be the influencers? Talk to me about some of the top moments in hip hop for 2019 as we close out the year. Talk to me about Lil Nas X. Is that a cultural moment or a gag moment?
I mean, I think it's a cultural moment, right? I mean, it forces us to have, you know, certain conversations, right? When we think about country, right? Country music, and we had this conversation in my class.
Well, hold on before you go on. I just want to let listeners know, because if you're not familiar, Lil Nas X has been on the, I don't know if it's in the number one position or in the Billboard top 100 for like 19 straight weeks. It is a culture. It's a country and western hip hop album, artists, whatever. Go on. Talk to me about what you guys talked about in class.
So the students, I mean, they were talking about this concept of an industry plant. They were like, yeah, Lil Nas X is an industry plant. Ain't nobody going to blow up that fast. They think he was, you know, backed by the industry. But the other conversation that we had was, you know, the interesting fact that they were trying to remove him from being country, right? And we talk about the origins of country and the origins of American music, and we talk about the fact that all American music was created by people of color, mm-hmm. right? And so we went through the blues, jazz, R&B, hip-hop, and then they were like, oh, yeah, right? And so you see this collaboration, right? And everybody wants to be a part of this black, cool aesthetic. And so to have him being also recognized in country and hip-hop, it made sense to me, right? It made sense to some of the students in the classroom. And like you said, like it took off, mm-hmm. like beyond belief.
Yeah, like, I listened to it, and because I've been in preparation. I hadn't heard the song, but I listened to it in prep for our conversation. It was pretty ugly. I ain't gonna lie. It's not my thing. But my producer Kevin Kloss said it kind of makes a little sense. You're marrying the two most popular music formats in the country, so it might make sense that it rises to that level. Another big moment of the year: Kanye goes gospel. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, Kanye is a polarizing figure, right? And so, you know, him going gospel. So you have people who, like, you know, certain Christians who are saying, you know, this is great. You never know who God is going to use, and it's beautiful that he's using his platform to talk about Jesus. Like, okay. And then you have other people who feel that he's opportunistic and mm-hmm. not necessarily doesn't espouse the views of Christianity. And then I listened to the album. I'm not sure if you listened to it. It's not like any other gospel album that I've heard before. Mm-hmm. You know, I loved Kanye, like his first four albums. Kanye, like, I think he's a musical genius. I think he goes off on a lot of tangents, a lot. But the production of the piece and the project is actually pretty good.
Okay.
Like the messaging of it, I'm not sure. It's not for me, but the as a lover of hip hop and Kanye's production, man, I think he did like a wonderful job. And even with the his Sunday service, the ways in which he's working with that choir, like they're unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
But politically, you know, Kanye West has been interesting to say the least this year.
Yeah. So what are some other top moments for you in 2019?
I think the fact that we entered a time where there was more than one female rapper who was being successful,
mm-hmm.
right? Certain times in hip-hop, it seemed like there was only room for one
mm-hmm.
woman at a time who could be successful. So, you know, having Lizzo, Rhapsody, Cardi B, City Girl, like so many different people, so many different women who were at the forefront of hip-hop. And I don't think that's happened in recent years.
Yeah.
And so I think that was huge.
Yeah, Megan Thee Stallion. Another. It does seem like 2019 was the year of the woman in hip hop for sure. And any others?
Yeah, I mean, like part of it, you know, Tekashi 6ix9ine piece, mm-hmm. you know, him, you know, people, you know, talking about him as a snitch, you know, the focus on mental health mm-hmm. within hip hop, you know, some deaths and the recent death of the young brother Juice WRLD. You know, it's been in a time when people are talking about, you know, drug use within hip hop culture, right?
Mm-hmm.
The shift, you know, people used to talk about selling drugs, but now people are bragging and glorifying the use of these drugs. And I think in the time when people are talking about mental health, I think we have to kind of get to the bottom of why people are so dependent on these methods of escape.
Yeah, we're losing some of these young artists in a way that it. I guess what I don't understand is, logically, you would think when you struggle to break free of something, you make it to the promised land that you would work hard to keep what you've gained. But sometimes it seems like we can't get out of our own way. Some of these young artists, and they're trying to hold on to something. That isn't beneficial in their lives. And so you look at artists still living a lifestyle that they are glorifying through music, which is fine if that's how you want to sell records, but living dangerously when you don't have to. What?
Mm-hmm.
Why are we still doing that? I look at the young man you just mentioned. He swallowed some drugs, I guess, because he got a tip that the police were going to as his plane was landing, we're gonna arrest him. The kid, XX Estacion, who mm-hmm. put himself in harm's way. So, is it the need to legitimize oneself to street culture one of the reasons why this kind of stuff still happens?
I mean, I think part of it is. Like one of the things that you hear people say is that money doesn't change you. Money makes you more of who you are,
mm-hmm.
right? And then, so I mean, there's this spoken word poet by the name of Black Ice, who talks about he says external blingers is all we can be because on the inside we've been given nothing to shine on, right? And so, like when you think about like self worth, like people want to put themselves forward. And glorify this life that they've never had, right? To make them feel that they're seen, that they heard, and that they matter. But the other part of it, like when I think about, you know, XXX, and when I think about Juice WRLD, when I think about Tupac, and then when I think about like someone like Jay-Z and Diddy, the difference is it's not that Jay-Z and them didn't, you know, live dangerously. The thing that benefited Jay-Z is longevity.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he had a chance to grow up and make it to 50 or however old he is.
Right.
You know, Juice WRLD and these guys, they're 21, and they don't get a chance to kind of learn and grow and develop. And so we don't get the opportunity to see what would have happened in their lives. And so longevity is what I think helps Jay-Z because he's not in the same mentality as he was as 21-year-old Jay-Z. And so we don't know what happens with the Juice WRLD if he were to get to 30, right?
Right.
You know, what things would change for him. And so a lot of these young brothers and sisters are just, they're dying. And they're leaving us too young without the opportunity to grow and fully develop.
That is a great point to end things on. Before I let you go, I'm going to put you on a spot. What are either your top three favorite historic hip hop acts, or who are your favorite three now?
Oh, man.
Ah. Okay.
I'll blend it. Like, my favorite rapper, anyone who knows me knows my favorite rapper is Big Daddy Kane.
Wow.
Just because of what he did for me and the ways in which I learned how to write by listening to him and styling my rhymes after his and similes and metaphors.
If you gave me 100 chances, I would not have guessed Big Daddy Kane.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Big Daddy Kane, I got a chance to meet him and everything. I was a little starstruck. I don't get starstruck very often, but he was big for me when, you know, his album came out when I was 12.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, a person who I listen to and mess with right now is I'm big on J. Cole.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think he's an unbelievable artist. And another artist of now who I love is Rhapsody.
Okay.
Her album Eve is unbelievable, and I can't believe it got snubbed.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check that out.
It's unbelievable.
Dawn Sawyer, Associate Professor of Sociology at Quinnipiac University and hip-hop aficionado. Thanks for spending some time with us, man.
I appreciate you having me, brother.
Hey, good talking to you. Have a great new year.
All right, you too.
Dawn teaches a sociology of hip-hop course at Quinnipiac for a timeline on notable moments in hip-hop's history and interviews with some of the music's early creators. Check out a recent article, Hip-Hop at Middle Age, in the December-January issue of AARP Magazine. That's going to do it for Pop Life for 2019. Thanks for spending the past year with us. Let us know what you'd like for us to explore in 2020 by dropping a comment on our Facebook page at Pop Life WAER. For our producer, Kevin Kloss, I'm Joe Lee. Have a very happy holiday. I'ma tell about a minimum length of rhymes with strength and power. So listen to the man of the hour. Flow and go to a slow tempo. And you know, sing ho, swing low, then yo, the show will go on. As I perform, transforming on stage like a Decepticon.